Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're very pleased today to be spending the hour with Ann Packer, author of two national bestsellers, the novels Songs Without Words and The Dive from Clausen's Pier, award-winning, and she's out with a new collection of stories, a novella and several stories called Swim Back to Me. Ann Packer will be in Utah on May 19th as part of the Sundance Author Series. And more information on that at sundance.org. Packer grew up near Stanford University. Her parents were both professors, lived, I believe, in Wisconsin and other areas, now back in the Bay Area. And Ann Packer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We appreciate you taking the time to be with us. What can people expect from your parents at Sundance? What do you generally do? Do some reading, question and answer?
It's going to be a combination of talking a little about how I became a writer and my writing process, and then talking specifically about my new book, and I'll probably read a few selections from it, and then take questions.
Very good. As I said, more information at the Sundance website. I believe generally midday, about 11 is when they open the doors, and lunch involved, and then about 1 o'clock is when the author starts talking. Beautiful setting, and we'll have good weather for you here. It's been good weather so far. You're on the road these days, or you will be at that point in support of Swim Back to Me.
Yes, I'm doing about an 8-day book tour next week, going to Boston, New York, Chicago, Portland. Then I get the cushy weekend at Sundance, and then Detroit before I come back home to San Francisco.
Before we get into Swim Back to Me, I want to talk about your very interesting family background. Your parents, both professors at Stanford, accomplished in their fields. Your mother, a writer, and I believe your brother, George Packer, accomplished as well. Is there competition? Is there pressure?
You know, it's very friendly. I did grow up in a very literary household. As you said, my mother is a writer and taught writing at Stanford for 35 years. So, and then my father was at the law school, a legal scholar, so literary/intellectual. My brother and I came at it very differently. He was always quite interested in writing and, you know, was the kid who was writing poems at age 7 and little short stories and producing abridgments of Shakespeare in the patio, that kind of thing. And I just wasn't interested at all until I got to college and a friend talked me into taking a writing course. And that's when it all changed for me. But we're very enthusiastic about each other's work and mutually supportive.
You dedicated this latest book to your brother.
It is. It's dedicated to my brother. And he likes to joke that in previous work, there were some very weird brothers, and he was always disturbed by the representation of brothers, and he's much happier being the dedicatee.
Rather than possibly or not being represented by the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you've said that in your household growing up, where some families would talk about famous athletes, you were talking about famous writers.
We were, yes. It was important to have a strong reasoned opinion of who was more important, Hemingway or Fitzgerald.
So is it inevitable with that background that you become a writer, do you think?
No, I don't think it's inevitable. I think that if I'd had another strong interest, I probably would have gone toward it just because the landscape was cluttered with writers. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, reading fiction was, one of my most important activities growing up. And so when I started to take writing classes and to discover that it was actually something I could do myself, I guess from that point on, it was sort of inevitable.
Mm. What does writing do for you? What's the attraction?
It's exciting, actually. It's a lot of fun. It's very difficult at times, but there's really nothing like sitting down at a keyboard, a piece of paper, whatever, and really making something out of nothing. And I'm a very organized person in life, and in writing, it's really flying by the seat of my pants. Very intuitive. I don't plan at all. And so what's challenging and crazy-making and thrilling is, you know, sitting down and not knowing as you begin the paragraph where it's going to end.
Usually it's family life, isn't it? Relationships. And there can be high drama. I'm thinking of the story Dwell Time, waiting for a call.
Right. You know, I do tend to work in the realm of domestic life. And yes, Dwell Time is a story about a woman in a second marriage. She's got two children. Her new husband has three children. And he doesn't come home from work one evening. And the story is about sort of the next 24 hours. And she's waiting to hear from him and also trying to take care of all five of these children. And it is rather dramatic, and there are some revelations that I won't give away.
Right. I wonder if I could have you read a little bit from Dwell Time. I'm not sure which edition of the book you have in front of you. I have the paperback.
I have a paperback, too, and
okay.
I'd be happy to. Do you want me to just start at the beginning?
I was thinking page 148.
Okay.
It's near the bottom. Trina made a face at Charlotte. Then continuing through the full next page. Let's see. To the kind of the middle of the next page.
Okay. Trina made a face at Charlotte and carried her plate to the sink. Laura watched as she stood there, her back to the room, shoulder blades like little fins. She wheeled around and said, "I think it's rude that he hasn't called you." "Maybe his phone died," Laura said. "Then he should borrow one," Trina said. "Duh." Charlotte cleared her plate, and both girls went to do homework. Laura scraped their uneaten enchiladas into the garbage. Matt didn't like it that she let them complain about her cooking. But what was she supposed to do? Say they had to like everything? He was a stricter parent than she in just about every way. His kids had firm bedtimes, and so now hers did too, fairness being the number one rule in every self-help book about stepfamilies and blending. Blending, Trina had said. What are we, ingredients? But it was an apt enough metaphor and a tough enough task. Two adults, five children, and 21 relationships. A few days before the wedding, 10 months ago now, they were coming up on their first anniversary. He had said out of the blue that of Laura's two, he thought the marriage and all it entailed would be harder on Charlotte. She'd adored him for that, not because he was right, though she believed he was, but because he had thought about it. He was such a funny combination, orderly, precise, even a little controlling about certain things, but also remarkably intuitive.
And then just the next paragraph.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
By 9:30, dread had invaded her body. She went upstairs and waited while Charlotte brushed her teeth. Then she turned off the light and sat on the edge of Charlotte's bed.
Then I wonder if we could read the first two paragraphs on page 150. It mm-hmm. kind of sets up the relationship and what
sure.
she's hoping for in this relationship.
Okay, so she's left Charlotte. She went into the bathroom and looked in the mirror. There were bits of dried spit at the corners of her mouth, and her pulse was wild. She turned on the shower and tried to cry. She was too terrified. Early on, she told him in passing that it was scary dating him. Puzzled, he asked why, and she said, "Because I like you." She had by then lost Adam, lost their family life, and she lost the girls every few days to the inexorable tides of joint custody. Matt was toned and fit, but he was well over 50. Behind the thick ropes of his triceps, over his sculpted pecs, his skin was soft and starting to droop. He took cholesterol-lowering drugs, and would probably have knee surgery in the next few years. Now, standing in the bathroom, she imagined that tender body of his, that body she loved, bleeding by the side of the road somewhere. She wanted to fling herself on it, shield it from harm.
It becomes pulse pounding. This is waiting for a phone call. You might think, well, you know, domestic life, family life. You're not in a military situation or other dramatic situation, but these moments can be full of high tragedy or high comedy.
Yeah, just high intensity. There's a lot hanging for her in hearing back from him. She hasn't been married to him for all that long, and so despite feeling that she knows him well, she knows that she doesn't know him perfectly well.
One of the things your characters go through, several of them, deception and self-deception. Dreams and the way you look at the world and the way those dreams change.
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of the time we have to tell ourselves certain stories about our experience in order to be able to continue with the adaptations that we've made to life. And I like, in my fiction, I like to sort of take a look at some of the moments where the self-deceptions no longer work or they get challenged and we have to sort of reconfigure our views of ourselves and often our views of other people. And there are moments where relationships can go awry or sometimes get better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lest we think it's all about loss in a bad way, I guess. Loss of pessimistic dreams can also happen.
Absolutely right. That's very true. That sometimes there's an attachment to a negative idea that in some perverse way keeps us comfortable. Maybe because then we don't have to hope, and that can get challenged, and sort of a new order becomes possible, and then you have to decide if you dare.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Anne Packer, author of two national best-selling novels, Songs Without Words and The Dive from Clausen's Pier. Her new book is a collection of stories. It begins with a novella and then continues with stories. The last story, by the way, loops around. We revisit some of the characters from the opening novella. It's called Swim Back to Me. Anne Packer will be in Utah, appearing with the Sundance Author Series. That's on May 19th. We have Anne Packer with us for the hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. I'm sure it's gratifying when you hit with a book like A Dive from Clausen's Pier. Is there pressure that comes from that?
You know, the success of The Dive from Clausen's Pier, which actually is now 10 years ago this spring, was so unexpected. It was a book that it took me a very long time to write. It was actually a 10-year writing process. And I really had no idea whether or not it would ever be published. And so when it was published and well-reviewed and then became a bestseller, I didn't have any expectation that anything like that would ever happen again, just because it was so unexpected in the first place. And I even assumed I would have to say that it wouldn't. So I have been pretty free since that experience from pressure about repeating the success or really thinking much about how a book would be received. I tend to get very involved in just what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis and then kind of hope for the best on the other side.
One variant on kind of a central theme of loss is grieving. And reading some of the reviews, I think one of the stories that's impacted people the most is the story Molten, second story in the collection. This is interesting, and I was reading that this came about from a student who took it upon himself to educate you about music. This was in the 90s.
Funny. I was teaching writing at San Francisco State University, and I guess I had my kids were probably 5 and 2 at that point. So, despite having, you know, at one point in my 20s been sort of up on music, I had kind of gotten to where I was really just listening to Raffi down by the bay and all those songs that children love. And this student of mine saw this gaping hole and started making me tapes of his favorite music, including a lot of punk rock. And, you know, some of it was noise to me, but I got very, very interested in it. And it became kind of a soundtrack for my life as a young mother driving children around, or dropping them off and then turning the music on, I should say, probably. and I can't really remember how the idea for the story Molten, which is about a woman whose teenage son has been killed in a commuter train accident. I don't remember how that got started or how the music sort of twined through that story, but they were completely dependent on each other. Working on this story about a mother's intense grief and giving her this way of coping, which was to listen to her son's music over and over and over again.
What if I could have you read just maybe the first page and a half from Molten?
Sure.
This is very interesting. And later in the story, I don't want to give too much away, that this becomes somewhat of an obsession, doesn't it? This is how she deals with her son's loss, sort of immersing herself in this music.
Yeah, it becomes kind of the thing she's doing instead of living her life. She's listening to his music. So you want me to start at the top?
Start at the top and maybe just go that half page and then the full page and up to the third paragraph of 102.
Okay. So this is the beginning of Molten. At 4:30, Catherine chose a last CD and put it into Ben's stereo. Low, gritty guitar chords burst from the speakers, the speed of a terrified heartbeat. She eased herself onto his beanbag chair, her head knocking time. I have a present. It is the present. You have to learn to find it within you. She loved this song, the hard, repeated chords, the singer's hoarse voice. Usually, she couldn't really enjoy the last CD. She was so busy dreading the moment when she'd have to stop for the day. 5:15, 5:20 at the latest, in order to be downstairs before Lainey got home from track practice, followed just a little later by Dave returning from work. Today was different, though. Both of them were going out tonight. Catherine would be back up here by 7:30, and then she'd have hours. A vast opportunity, a bonus, a reprieve. The verse went on, building to a glorious burst of sound, guitar bright and dirty at the same time, the fierce rat-a-tat of the drums. And then this is a lyric. If you could save yourself, you could save us all. Go on living, prove us wrong. Your leap of faith could be a well-timed smile. Survival never goes out of style. A philosophy of life, a philosophy of life in a rock song, a wake-up call of a rock song. Catherine might have been surprised before. Now she knew. Ben's music contained everything. She sang along to the next song, impatient without knowing why, until the third one started and she understood she'd been waiting for it. It was her favorite on the album, the one she was always happiest to hear, although happy wasn't really the word. Ravished was more like it. She was ravished by the opening torrent of sound, by the way it thinned into a rocky stream of notes, and then into the vocals. Dreamed I was a fireman. I just smoked and watched you burn. The first time she heard that line, she thought it was Jingo was a fireman. Like the opening of a children's story, Ben would have found that hilarious. Dreamed I was an astronaut. I shot you down like a juggernaut. Dreamed we were still going out. Had that one a few times now. Woke up to find we were not. It's good to be awake. Actually, the first time she heard it, she couldn't tell what the words were. It was just noise across the board. Racket. This band and nearly every other. Of course, that was only about a week after the funeral. She could hardly understand her husband then. Still, horrible as most of it sounded, she kept listening. First to 10-second bits, then to whole songs, whole albums. And it took. There were still bands she couldn't stand, but others. The way one singer sort of half screamed and half laughed. The deep, velvety dee-dee-dee-doo of a bass. The clatter and roll of a drum set. And the guitars. There'd been a moment early on when she suddenly stopped and asked herself just what instrument she was hearing. And when the answer dawned on her, obvious and shocking, her face actually filled with heat. Guitar. Electric guitar. What had she thought it was? A trumpet? How could she have arrived at the age of 45 without knowing how an electric guitar sounded? She loved guitar now. The edgy, off-sounding chords, the quick up-and-down wail of a line of notes, the occasional sweet, high, shimmering trill. Guitars could sing, cry, whisper, growl. Awesome, as Ben would have said. Dreamed I was a dream. I stole you away in your sleep. Saved you from a fire, a gun for hire. I introduced you to a vampire. A song was a dream. That's what Catherine thought now. A song was someone else's dream, and when you listened to it, you became part of it, and you were linked to all the other people who had listened to it, and all the people who would listen to it in times to come. In a phantom space somewhere, she and Ben floated behind dozens of songs together, hundreds of songs, separated by an enormous crowd.
This is Catherine, who's lost her son, Ben, in an accident. It's very, very beautiful, very telling. In a phantom space somewhere, she and Ben floated. It's not reality. She's escaping.
Right, exactly. And I won't give away the way the story proceeds and ends, but what happens on this day of listening to music, or actually I guess it's the next day, is that she makes a step back into the real world.
Hmm. There's another passage a little later on where she's reading a note from the parents of a young man that had been helped to save in this incident. And she rejects it. She rejects the sentiment. She rejects the idea of heroism. Ben's just gone. That's the bottom line. I wonder what your feelings are. You certainly write about the grieving process and how we move forward or not with this story. Do we ever move forward? Are we always just surviving when we lose someone?
I think that movement is always going to be in both directions, and that there, maybe there's a trend forward, but in a situation where one is grieving after a loved one has died, I think that it's not linear at all. In the wonderful book by Joan Didion in The Year of Magical Thinking, she, I remember, talks about grief coming in waves. And to me, that's very, very true of the experience. And I think it's something that I've tried to convey when I've written about grief, as I've done in a number of my works.
Mm-hmm. And people maybe who don't know your background, you lost your father when you were young.
I did, yeah. My father had a stroke when I was 10 years old and then committed suicide when I was 13. So that was one of those, sort of blueprint experiences for a young girl.
Yeah. Especially hard at that age? I guess it's never easy.
I think it probably is pretty hard at 13. Somebody said to me, you don't want to die when they're 2 and you don't want to die when they're 13. I'm not sure where that comes from. 13 is a time of enormous change. So I think that that's probably why people look at that as particularly risky time for loss.
Yeah. I want to talk about the music. You've written, or just an interview, you said a lot of your characters have sensory experiences that are important to whatever story is unfolding around them. This is something you realized.
You know, I think that I think what I was probably talking about, I don't recall the interview in particular, but is that for me to make what's happening on the page seem real to the reader, it's important to convey the world of sensory experience that the characters are living in, so that it's sort of like using a lot of visual detail, but using detail of the other senses as well. So I tend to want to convey what my characters are smelling also, and feeling with their hands, and tasting and hearing, as well as what they're seeing. And for me as a reader, when writers do a lot of that kind of establishing and a lot of that kind of work in their fiction, I am most likely to really be in the scene with the characters.
Mm. That detail is important.
Yes.
Yeah. Are these real songs? These real bands?
They are. They're real songs. It's funny, when I when I sold the story to a magazine, the editor said, you know, I assume these are all made up. If not, we're going to have some problems with permissions. And I said, oh no, they're not made up. We are going to have some problems with permissions. But it wasn't a matter of problems. It's just a matter of paying to be able to use them.
Now, were these on the mixtapes that your student gave you?
They were. I think every song in the story was on one tape or another.
Yeah. Otherwise, I wonder, probably like me, after a certain point, you stop being connected with pop music.
Right. Exactly. And there's quite a range. The songs that are in this story are a range of bands and styles. And that was sort of what was fun for me, was just, in a way, it mimics my writing process in general, in that I don't really plan a lot. I also wasn't really planning what songs I was going to have Catherine listen to, and it kind of occurred to me as the story progressed, oh, maybe it would be this song or that song.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are connected up, obviously. By the way, at the website, annpacker.com, if you click on Swim Back to Me, there's a playlist. And you could actually listen to these while you're reading Moulton. Some of these I do recognize: the Pixies, Violent Femmes, Velvet Underground, Soul Asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Others I don't, but there's that available for you. We're talking with Ann Packer, who's author of a couple of best-selling novels, including The Dive from Clausen's Pier. She's out with a new collection of stories called Swim Back to Me, and she'll be at Sundance on May 19th, the Sundance Author Series. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be back and talk about some of the other stories, including the opening novella, a very interesting coming-of-age story in 1972, and then we revisit a couple of those characters in the last story several decades later. Also, a very touching story, a young husband, they're expecting a baby, but their lives are haunted by the ghost, you could say, of a loss from a previous marriage, the wife's previous marriage. All of that to come following this break.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
The weather is warming up, and it's time to revisit the colossal mistake again. We originally saw it hanging from the ceiling at Costco. In another store, we might have immediately noticed that the tent was bigger than a small convenience store, but in Costco, it was about the same size as a standard bag of dog food or marshmallows. I began to see images of my family in the wilderness around the glow of a campfire with a cozy 12-person tent as a backdrop. My children, who sometimes find creative ways to take revenge on their father, encouraged me to buy it. My wife Barbara was not there. Barbara has poo-pooed proposed purchases of really cool family-building things such as 5-in-1 foosball tables an indoor inflatable hot tub, and an indoor paintball target range. She claims there's no room left in her house for such things, even though there's plenty of room left in the kitchen and the upstairs bathroom. I reasoned that a tent goes in the great outdoors where there's lots of space. I bought the tent. We discovered, however, that it's difficult to find public campsites that are big enough for Costco tents. So sometimes we had to move the campsite picnic table inside the tent to get it up without it taking over adjacent campsites. Not that anyone would mind us taking over a little campsite real estate. We find that once we start setting up the tent, others nearby find it so entertaining that they pull up their little camp chairs and turn their backs on their own campfires just to watch our project unfold. It has several rooms, an upstairs and a pantry, and it can take a good part of the day to put it up, unless you want it to look like it does in the box. If that's the case, it can take 2 days. We have discovered camping isn't as easy as it looks. The part where you're supposed to sleep on the ground, for example, seems to be a problem. Most of the time we lay there wide awake, wondering what thought process we use to decide that for fun we should leave our comfortable beds and sleep on the ground outside. I also find that as soon as I'm comfortable and everyone is quiet, I must go to the bathroom. I try to make those impulses go away by thinking about such topics as, will the smell of smoke ever leave my clothes? And should I set fire to the tent in the morning? It doesn't work, and I eventually have to get up and go off into the scary blackness. Going out by myself always gives me the creeps because I can never find a flashlight, and I hear sounds everywhere. I'm not afraid of the dark, but I do find myself afraid of things that hide in the dark. On a recent campout, a raccoon the size of a small bear strolled into our campsite. When I tried to scare him away, he reared up on his back legs and made a motion to me with his paws, like, "You want some of me? Come on, big boy, bring it on." I wouldn't want to meet a raccoon like that in the darkness. What if there's a vengeful father deer waiting out there to charge me, creating a very embarrassing moment? Another problem is the rain. It seems it always wants to rain, not just on the outside of our tent, but also on the inside of it. In Boy Scouts, I learned that there are ways to stay dry, but I can never remember if the tarp you put under the tent is supposed to stick out or be tucked under. I also remember something about digging a tiny moat, but every defensive tactic I take seems to actually funnel water directly into the tent. Once I went as an adult chaperone on a scout campout. I went to the scout leader and humbly asked for help. "No matter what happens, I always end up getting wet," I said. "Please teach me the ways of the mountain man." He set up my tent with the proper tarps and rainflies and topped the setup off with a large tarp the size of an aircraft carrier that he suspended over my tent by tying it impressively to several nearby trees with real scout knots. The forecast was for sunny skies and no rain. The tiny tent looked impressive, shielded from everything. I crawled in the tent and reveled in the protection I had been granted by simply asking for help. I celebrated by digging a water bottle out of my backpack, and as I went to get a drink, the lid popped off, and I was immediately soaked within my dry universe. Despite the obstacles, we've had some good experiences. We get postcards from campers asking us if we'll be performing next in the same campsite, so we've earned some respect. We've taken a new camping approach, however, that seems to work better than anything we've tried before. We leave the tent at home, drive to the scenic setting, and enjoy it until the sun goes down. Then we drive to the nearest Costco, where we snag brand new tent chairs, kick back, and gaze at the already assembled 5-room tents. We marvel at their beauty and wonder about the people who are capable of not only putting them up, but hanging them from ropes high above the floor. Sure, the nice people at Costco make us go home at closing, but it doesn't matter. We're clean, dry, and refreshed. And because we drive a station wagon and travel light, we have room to take home a real camping treat. One Costco-sized bag of marshmallows. This is Steve Eaton.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Ann Packer. She's a best-selling author of The Dive from Clausen's Pier and other books. Her new book is Swim Back to Me, Stories. Opens with a novella, Walk for Mankind, and wraps back around the last story. Revisits some of the characters from that novella. In between, some very affecting stories. Some of the themes, loss and deception, self-deception, and the effects of the past on the present and the future. Ann Packer is coming to Utah for the Sundance Authors Series. That is on May 19th. More information at the Sundance website, which is sundanceresort.com. And Ann Packer, our guest, for another 20 minutes here. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. I wonder, how do you put a collection like this together, Ann Packard? I believe these stories were written over several years. When it comes time to thinking about how this will all fit together, how does that process work?
It's interesting because you definitely, the order matters. I did write the stories over a number of years, actually, maybe even over a decade, and I knew I wanted to start with the novella that you mentioned, Walk for Mankind, mainly because of the length. It felt like the long piece should be at the beginning of the book, but also I think because of the time period during which it's set. It's in the early 70s, and so chronologically for the book, starting with the historic piece, so to speak, seemed right. And then arranging the rest of the stories was a matter of wanting to go from Walk for Mankind, the novella, to something that would be very different but powerful. And so Moulton, the story about the woman grieving the loss of her teenage son, seemed like a good choice. And then as I was conceiving of the book as a whole, I knew that I was going to finish up with a story that picked up with some of the characters from Walk for Mankind many decades later, and so that was a natural end point for the book.
I wonder if you'd read us the opening of Walk for Mankind.
Sure.
It's the first maybe couple of pages.
Okay.
Introduce us to these characters. We'll talk about them.
Right, and I'll just jump right in here. Walk for Mankind. September 1972. It was the first week of eighth grade, and I sat alone near the back of the school bus, a short, scrawny honor roll boy with small hands and big ears. The route home meandered through Los Altos Hills, with its large houses sitting in the shadows of old oak trees and dense groves of eucalyptus. Finally, we came down out of the hills and arrived in Stanford, where the last 20 or so of us lived, in houses built close together on land the university leased to its faculty. A couple of stops before mine, a clump of kids rose and moved up the aisle, and that's when I saw her, a new girl, sitting up near the front. To my surprise, she shouldered her backpack at my stop. I waited until she was off the bus, and then made my way up the aisle, keeping my eyes away from Bruce Kavanaugh and Tony Halpern, who'd been my friends back in elementary school. Down on the bright sidewalk, she was headed in the direction I had to go, and I followed after her, walking slowly so I wouldn't overtake her. She was small-boned like me, with thick red hair spilling halfway down her back and covering part of her backpack, which was decorated with at least a dozen McGovern buttons rather than the usual one or two. There was even a Nixon button with a giant red X drawn over his ugly face. She stopped suddenly and turned, and I got my first glimpse of her face, pale and peppered with freckles. "Who are you?" she said. "Sorry." I was afraid she thought I was following her when I was just heading home. She came forward and offered me her hand. "Hi, sorry. I'm Sasha. Or maybe I should say, I'm new. We can call each other sorry and new, and then when we get to know each other better, we can switch to something else, shy and weird maybe." I had never met anyone who talked like this, and it took me a moment to respond. My name's Richard. She rolled her eyes. I know that. I didn't mean, who are you, what's your name? I meant, who are you, who are you? Your name is Richard Appleby, and you live around the corner from me in the house with all the ice plant. Now I got it. She was part of the family renting the Levine's house. Teddy Levine was spending the year at the American Academy in Rome, and the Levine kids were going to go to some Italian school and come back fluent and probably strange. The Jacksons had spent a year in London, and afterward Helen Jackson had been such an oddball, her parents had taken her out of public school. The girl's hand was still out, and though I'd never shaken hands with another kid before, I held mine out for her, and she pumped it up and down. She had blue-gray eyes with very light lashes and a long, pointy nose. Sasha Horowitz, she said. Happy to know you. I was waiting for you to come over, but it's just as well we met like this. If you'd come over, I'd have probably been a freak. Plus, my parents would have co-opted the whole thing. Do your parents do that? Co-opt everything? When I was really little, my dad always tried to play with me and my friends. He'd give us rides on his back like a horse, and he'd kind of buck sometimes. And one time, a friend of mine fell off and broke her wrist. Her parents were really overprotective. She was never allowed to come over again. Still looking at me, Sasha shrugged off her backpack and ran her fingers through her heavy carrot-colored hair. She gathered it into a thick ponytail and secured it with a rubber band from her wrist. She said, "There, that's better. So do you love San Francisco? We had a picnic in Golden Gate Park on Saturday, and we saw a guy on an acid trip. My little brother thought he was in a play. The only thing is, I'm expecting to be miserable about missing winter." "Are you from somewhere cold?" I said. "Did you have snow?" "New Haven. And God, yes, we had mountains of it. It was a huge pain in the ass. Do you want to come over? You should, because my mother will ask me to tell her about school otherwise, and I really don't feel like talking to her."
The opening of Walk for Humanity, that's the opening novella, Walk for Mankind, I should say, the opening novella in the new collection from Ann Packer, Swim Back to Me. Imagine that was fun, that setting.
It was, and it's very much a time and place that I experienced firsthand. I think that it was an easy automatic choice for me to make these characters the exact age that I was in 1972. So the cultural references, the sort of the world of Stanford University in Palo Alto at that time were a lot of fun for me to recreate.
The fathers play a prominent role here, and the children's perceptions of their fathers, and that will continue later. Richard thinks of his father, I think, is kind of boring.
His father is a history professor, and I remember a friend reading the manuscript for me at some point and saying, you know, today everybody would think this guy had Asperger's. He's a somewhat socially awkward father who is trying to do his best, but doesn't really have any sense of what his son is going through emotionally. And it's important to say that Richard's mother has left the father and moved to Oakland. And so Richard and his father are alone in this house. And it's into that background that Sasha and her family, the Horowitzes, move into a house around the corner. And Sasha's father, Dan, is sort of the exact opposite of Richard's father. He's very dynamic, charismatic, ultimately very narcissistic, as we learn in the final story in the book, Things That Are Done, when the narrative switches to Sasha's point of view. She's telling the story. 35 years have gone by, and she and her father are attending a family wedding.
And Richard doesn't appear in that last story.
He doesn't, and that was not something that I knew when I first started writing Things That Are Done. I thought that the story, the final story in the book, was going to bring Richard and Sasha back together. I knew I was going to be writing from Sasha's point of view, but I wrote a draft, or I at least started a draft, where Richard tracked her down. but it didn't work. I was more interested in what seemed to be percolating between her and her father. In fact, the story really started with my thinking about this character, Dan, the former English professor, complaining bitterly to his adult daughter about his health and his fears of dying.
And it's
bitterly and comically, I should say.
Yes. Dan is a very interesting character. He feels personally injured by Watergate, for example.
Yes.
And you could see how Richard would be attracted to this other father. It's interesting how, and you've talked about this, relationships take on different flavor as you go through time.
Yes, and for Sasha and her father, in her girlhood, when she's 13 years old, 14 years old, which is when Walk for Mankind takes place, they have a relationship where the father is very entertained by and overly invested in his daughter, but also watching her sort of run headlong into some adolescent behaviors that are disturbing and that he doesn't want to see. And so as her caretaker, he's somewhat blinding himself to reality. And then the tables turn, and 35 years later, she's really his caretaker, and he's sort of gone from this charismatic man to really a sort of terminally narcissistic burden on her, but someone who won't be ignored. He's like a constant presence at her side.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the story, Her Firstborn. This is
That's actually the oldest story in the book. I wrote that story in the late 90s while I was on a break from writing The Dive from Clawson's Pier. And it grew out of, I think, my first experience with being pregnant and having a baby. And I knew someone, I think, in my childbirth class who had lost a child in a previous marriage, lost her firstborn, literally, in a previous marriage. And now she was married to someone new, and they were expecting their first child. Mm. And I was very interested and moved by the courage that I thought it must take for them to be doing that. And that the story grew out of that. It's told from the point of view of the new husband, Dean. And he is married now to Lisa, who was formerly married to another man and had lost his child. And Lisa's pregnant, and they're anticipating the birth of their child. But Dean can't stop thinking about, essentially, the dead baby.
Hmm. And there's a very telling phrase use. He's wanting to look, I think you phrase it, inside the chamber where she keeps all that. There's a part of her, the part of the wife, that he can't get to. And I think that's a theme that runs through some of your work, the intimacy or the failure of intimacy, what characters say and what they don't say.
Yeah, the can't or the won't or the isn't yet able to. Mm-hmm. I think that in some ways, Dean is fooling himself about what he can and can't do, and it's only at the end of the story when he recognizes his own complicity in staying outside of it.
Hmm. There's a phrase or an idea in one of the reviews. I think it's the New York Times review. Linda Peel. She sees a connection in these stories to California, not only the setting, but sort of about California. I wonder if you're familiar with that review, and if you agree. She likens California to a sort of a graying person, lost sort of their freshness, seen their crises, and it's time to pick up the pieces. I don't know if you see.
I've forgotten about this, actually. I've forgotten that she... I think she starts that way.
Yes,
that way. Yeah, I I wouldn't say, I certainly California's in big trouble, and more so than many other states, but I don't think of the book as being about California, really.
Hmm. What do you read?
I read in such a meandering fashion. You know, of course, I'm like any other avid reader of fiction, and then I buy books constantly, and they pile up, and I have at any given time, you know, 10 things that are the book I'm going to read next. And then there's The New Yorker sitting there, which is a particular pleasure for me because both my brother and his wife write for The New Yorker, and my my sister-in-law actually has an article in the current issue about Iran that's really interesting and disturbing reading. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm reading a novel called 10,000 Saints by Eleanor Henderson. That's just wonderful. I think my big revelation of the last few months was Carry the One by Carol Anshaw. I can't recommend that book highly enough.
Mm. I was reading a piece you published in Real Simple. Mm-hmm. It's June of 2011. I think I found this at your website. Interesting glimpse into your family life. You're talking about carpooling and now lamenting giving up carpooling because your kids are old enough to drive themselves.
Yeah, you know, it was not something that I really anticipated until my older child started driving. I have two who are 3 years apart, and when my older child got her license, I was suddenly never in the car with her anymore, and that was, you know, one of our main times to just kind of be together. So I saw it coming with my son, and the article you're talking about is sort of about, you know, the anticipation of losing the car time, both, you know, with your child and also with your child and his friends, and the way you get to be sort of a fly on the wall as you drive, you know, these children who you knew at age 7 but who are now 16 and wisecracking and have deep voices, and everything has changed.
Mm-hmm. We're out of time. I believe you have said that there's probably a novel coming next.
There will be a novel next, yes.
Anything you want to say about that?
I don't really talk much about it while I'm doing it, but I will say that it's a novel about a family, probably no big shock there, set around here. But what's different for me this time is that I have a kind of a wider canvas. It's going to cover a lot more time, and it's going to cover a larger family and get into the experiences of 6 different people.
Very good. We'll look for that. Ann Packer has been our guest. She's a best-selling author of Dive from Clausen's Pier and other works. Her new book is a collection of stories, Swim Back to Me, and she'll be in Utah at the Sundance Author Series on May 19th. Ann Packer, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.